Welcome to the WWE podcast. Now, this is my second episode of the weekend, or the week. Well, this is because it's WrestleMania season, it's WrestleMania weekend, we've had the two-day event. If you listen to my prediction show, my SmackDown review for the 3rd of April, then you know that I'm also going to do a WrestleMania review for the Blue Brand. So that's the weekly matchups, the weekly feuds that I normally review. So that's why I want to just see if I've got my predictions right or what I want to happen. Did it come true? Did it happen? And then obviously just review it as I would a normal episode, and then I'll carry on as normal, giving you the weekly update, the weekly review of SmackDown. So we had WrestleMania Part 1. It seemed a little bit SmackDown heavy. It was a little bit Blue Brand heavy, but that's okay. I think it was just the way the matches fell. I actually think Part 1 and Part 2 were quite evenly stacked for me. I know a lot of people online were saying that Part 2 was probably the better night on paper. But I didn't really see that. I actually thought that both were very evenly stacked. And it was just the fact that Part 1 had more SmackDown and Part 2 had more Raw. I think that was just the way it happened. So all of this will be SmackDown, so don't listen to this if you want an Edge and Orton review or an AJ Styles Undertaker review or McIntyre Brock Lesnar review. This is solely for SmackDown to carry on what I talk about each week and then obviously lead into the week coming. So on the kickoff show, we had Drew Gulak versus Cesaro. Now, it was what a kickoff show is. It's not overly exciting. It was basically two superstars that didn't have any other thing to do, any other storyline, any other feud, which is a bit of a shame for Drew Gulak because of his like recent push recently. There's not really too much to say. I doubt even everyone watched it, so I'll keep it short. It was a lot of countering what you could expect from Drew Gulak. So you had a counter style from Drew Gulak in a technical sort of snap counters and everything like that, and then the also counter style from Cesaro, which was very strong. He showed his strength, his power in that sort of counter, so it was very back and forth. For me, it was a very bad finish again. Cesaro had Gulak up on his shoulders and did an aeroplane spin, sort of like fall away slam in a way, just sort of slammed him on the floor. It didn't look powerful. The slam, it could maybe be a good move because I'm sure someone else does a very similar one. But the fact he does this spinning thing like he used to do where like, he holds the legs of a superstar and spins them round, I never enjoyed that. And the move itself to finish this match, it was more the fact about the spinning than it was anything else. So, like, are you really going to take a pinfall off a spinning move? For me, you're not, so it takes the believability out of it. But it was okay. It was okay to kick off the show. Again, it didn't have any fans, so you didn't really get the reaction. But the commentary team did enough to make it feel like a WrestleMania match in a way, or at least a kickoff show match. So yeah, I didn't really enjoy it. It was just two superstars that didn't have a story. They're sort of like caught up in the whole Daniel Bryan, Sami Zayn storyline anyway. And the fact that Drew Gulak has had that mini push, and I've been wanting him to be that sort of like manager type coach for Daniel Bryan, even though he's turned into a sidekick. And now he's just losing against Cesaro on a kickoff show in a very poor, poor way. Not even like getting beat. Or not even like getting a roll up where it's like, ah, it's unlucky or Cesaro's cheating. He's actually lost to a move that didn't even look painful. So to me, that was a little bit disappointing. We then moved on to absolutely horrific choice of an WrestleMania host in Rob Gronkowski and Mojo Rawley. Oh my God, shocking. Terrible, bad, whatever word you want to throw in there, it was awful. Like them two together, Gronk on his own, Mojo on his own now as well. They are just shocking. They are terrible. Like just watching them annoyed me. Just watching them, as soon as they come on, WrestleMania's kicked off, we're all excited, we're all intrigued to see about how this two-day event's going to happen, about this, how the no-fan situation's going to happen, what's, how are they going to act, how's this going to happen. Everyone is on almost like the edge of the seat, waiting to see what happens, and yet these two absolute clowns, like, and I would use stronger words, but let's keep this like child friendly, but it's just frustrating to watch. So that is the only thing I'm going to say about them in this episode. I mean, I'm not going to go into anything to do with them Gronk's 24/7 championship win and Mojo's win and all of that. Honestly, I just want to leave them there and just throw it away and never speak about them again on this episode. And if hopefully they go back to Raw, so I don't have to talk about them. But anyway, yeah. So that's my feelings on the situation. So then we had a women's tag team match for the SmackDown titles. So we had Kabuki Warriors versus Bliss and Cross. Now, I thought it was a very, very good match, actually. There was a little bit too much screaming. I was a little bit disappointed in the fact how, like, I know the Kabuki Warriors are all about them screaming. It's very, like, Japanese and everything like that. But it's just a little bit too annoying. It almost makes it so obvious that they're women, in a way, because of the screams, because of the high-pitched squeals, like... It's just not nice to watch. It's annoying more than anything. You're watching it, you're trying to invest in the match, because ultimately it's quite a good storyline about how Asuka attacked Alexa Bliss, and it sort of turned into a tag team match. So it was just a little bit of a letdown in that sense. I liked the way Alexa Bliss was strong. Again, as if you listen to my episodes a lot, you will understand that I like her. She's one of my favourite women. She was very strong in the match. I thought they were all very strong in the match. I thought Nikki was the standout star. She had a lot to play. She had a big, big impact on the match, where really Alexa Bliss was a little bit sidelined in a way, because Nikki Cross, really, that's how the tag team won. That's how Bliss and Cross won the match, really. It was from Nikki. I thought Kairi Sane was a little bit of a letdown. I didn't think her moveset was as crisp as it normally is. I think some of the moves were just a little bit scrappy. But then again, she is quite small and she's been out of action for a little while. But I was very, very impressed with Nikki Cross. Now, she basically created the platform for Alexa Bliss to perform the Twisted Bliss and get the win. So going forward, they're the now tag team champions. I can't see this feud lasting too long. I think Asuka's going to end up going to singles matches, which I think is probably a good move. And I'd actually give Kairi Sane a run in singles matches as well, just to see how she fares. I mean, she can easily hold her own against the types of Dana Brooke or Liv Morgan or Ruby Riott. Now, I know obviously some of them are on Raw, but I was just trying to give you that category of a woman's division that I reckon that she could slot in quite nicely there. Next up, we had Corbin versus Elias. Now, obviously, I'm not going to go in order on how the WrestleMania went. I'm going to go in order on how the SmackDown matches went. So we had Corbin versus Elias. Now, there was a little backstage segment, which, again, I found it a little bit annoying, because you had Baron Corbin like do some harmonica song. He had a harmonica and he was backstage getting an interview, and he started doing some song, a bit like basically taking the mick out of Elias, because he obviously plays the guitar and makes up his own songs. But I just found this very, very cringy and very childlike, since like Corbin's meant to be this big bad heel, big bad guy. Like, do you really get a heel and a bad guy in this sort of like, I don't care, this like no rules type of guy, I don't listen to anyone, do this little childlike like song, trying to wind the other person up? I don't think so. I've never seen anyone in real life. Like, I know this is all storyline, but I like to relate it, and I find it more believable if it is related to real life. But really, like a bully type person doing a little song on harmonica, no, it's not for me. But saying that, when he actually came out for the match, it was just a typical heel versus babyface, which I was so excited for. He came out. It was a typical heel move, claiming he should win by forfeit. Elias comes out and he smashes the guitar over Corbin. So he smashes it over his back on the ramp. This is before the match has started. And then it leads to an unbelievably physical and aggressive match that we haven't actually seen too much of that from Elias. I mean, they worked extremely well and there was no botches that I picked up. There was a few too many shoulder tackles, like through the ropes to the turnbuckle, to the support on the outside. I'm sure you know what I mean by that. But I thought a bit of variation using maybe the barricades outside or the announce table to throw the opponent on would just give us that different viewing angle as well as a different move. However, I think the reason they used this shoulder tackle was because Elias had already injured his shoulder through the drop from the platform on SmackDown. So I think that is probably the reason. But then again, if you actually watch the tackles that Elias was being thrown through the ropes and hitting his shoulder, that sometimes he was hitting the other shoulder. So whether that was a little bit of a mistake or a slight botch or just the way it was meant to happen, like, if you're aiming at a shoulder because he's got a bad shoulder, why are you throwing him on the other one? Like, unless you're trying to injure both, but surely, and how many times we've watched it in the past, you go after the injured shoulder, you go after the injured leg or whatever body part it is. You wouldn't try and injure the other one. That's just what I noticed anyway. Corbin tried to cheat using the ropes for the pin, and Elias gets the roll up while the ref was telling Corbin off. Now, this was a typical heel versus face. Corbin was shouting at the ref and shouting at the announcers, shouting at JBL, shouting at Michael Cole. I mean, for me, this feud has to continue. It felt like a Mania match. It felt WrestleMania worthy. I mean, it would have been better with, obviously, the fans' reactions, especially with Elias's sort of like repeat after me start slight taglines, like the who wants to walk with Elias and what does WWE stand for and everything like that. But to me, Corbin plays the heel so well, whether there's a crowd there, whether he's on his own in the ring, whether he's just on the mic, whether he's against someone, whatever it is, he is a perfect heel. Elias is a great face, he's popular, and it just worked. It really did feel like a Mania match, and I think they've done themselves proud. I hope the feud continues, and I hope they get some stipulation matches in the future, similar to, like, Elias has had that Symphony match with Braun Strowman before, and obviously Corbin has recently had that sort of like street brawl with Roman Reigns where they went through the Minute Maid Stadium. So both of them are used to having them sort of stipulation matches, and it just brings the feud even further, makes that hatred even more volumized and everything like that. So to me, great match. Moving forward, let's like pump up the jam a little bit, add a little bit more, and really get that hatred flowing. So moving on, we had Daniel Bryan versus Sami Zayn for the Intercontinental Championship. So Gronk and Mojo being as annoying as ever again, both just ruined the whole thing for me whenever they got involved. They were shown on the camera doing, I know they were only doing yes chants, but just leave them backstage behind a sheet or behind a curtain and just leave them there the whole night. Just forget they're there. That's what I would do. But the match started. It was classic Sami Zayn avoiding the confrontation in the ring. Although some fans may find this frustrating, a short amount of the time, it works. Like, it works well for me, especially from Sami's character and his persona. I mean, it's a mind game using practically the full 10 count and then having Shinsuke and Cesaro block Daniel Bryan when he tries to get him. Gulak takes out both Sami's henchmen and allows Bryan to get his hands on Sami Zayn, bringing him to the ring. Sami's vocals throughout this match, like, it made the fear and the unwant of being in the ring, it just that much more believable. Bryan just continued to aggressively beat up Sami with Sammy not really retaliating or having any comeback at all, just with these loud moans with "oh gods" and complaining at what is happening and almost crying at some point, which was actually quite amusing to see because the heel was getting hurt so badly. And I know it's all kayfabe, but Sammy plays these personas so well. He's cocky, and then when he's face to face and when he has to do some work in the ring, he gets all worried and starts almost crying, complaining and everything. And he just plays this sort of like character so well. So Sammy has a little bit of a comeback, but Brian basically gets back on top quite quickly. Cesaro and Shinsuke return to attack Gulak, which distracts Brian. Brian then dives through the ropes to save Gulak, and he lands on Cesaro and Shinsuke from the Artistic Collective, I think they're called. But Daniel then returns to the ring. He climbs up to the top rope. He dives off the top rope towards Sammy, and Sammy performs this beautiful Huluva kick, and it's all over. 1, 2, 3, bang, pin, Sammy retains, and that's it. For me, it made the Huluva kick look strong, and it played him off as even more vulnerable, which is interesting to see what happens after Mania. The reason I say Huluva kick strong is because you see a lot nowadays, a lot of finishes, especially at main events or like pay-per-views, it takes a lot of finishes to get the pin, basically. Like, you see how many spears, like Goldberg would have to do, or how many F5s Brock Lesnar would have to do, or whatever move it is. There's a hell of a lot of them when basically it's a finisher move. So you should almost build up to it. Maybe one. Obviously, if it's a huge main event, you might get a couple, like as we've seen in the past. You might get two, and then maybe finish with a third one, but that would be after, again, some more move set. But this made it look strong. One, and Daniel Bryan's down for the count. Again, Gulak just seemed pointless to Brian. It didn't make sense why he was out there. Cesaro and Shinsuke are in a faction led by Sammy, so you can understand why they are there. But Gulak just seems pointless, and I know they all had their part to play in terms of attacking each other on the outside. But Gulak's actual reference to being there for Brian is just a waste of time, because he's not a coach. What they were sort of like portraying, the whole Daniel Bryan learning off of Gulak it's not like evident anymore, so you don't even know. And just because we've watched it for weeks and we know the beginnings of why they're together, if you just tuned in, say you missed that 1 week of SmackDown, say you, I don't know, you're on holiday or whatever. Well, holidays now are long gone, aren't they, because of coronavirus, but say you'd missed it for whatever reason, then you tuned in the next week, you'd look at it and be like, why are they together? What's the meaning behind it? And there's no real explanation. I do not know why they have booked them two the way they have. I would say that now Sammy's retained, personally, I don't want this feud to continue, because I don't like the way they've done it. I don't really want the pairing to continue unless they book it differently. So I could probably see a Gulak turn or a Bryan turn. And I can only assume that is coming. I think that is probably going to happen. But then again, if Gulak turns or Bryan turns and that becomes a one-on-one feud, Gulak is only going one way, and that's down. That is down the roster even further than he was before. So maybe just a trip to NXT is probably better, unless WWE sort out his bookings. Now, I'm just going to go back slightly. I don't want to record all what I've done. I forgot to actually mention all my predictions. So, firstly, we had Gulak versus Cesaro, the kickoff show. I didn't really make a prediction for this, and even if I knew it was going on, I wouldn't even bothered. To me, it's just a little bit of a waste of time. It was more kickoff show, who can we make on there? So I'm not too worried about that. The Kabuki Warriors versus Bliss and Cross. Now, I predicted that there would be new champions, so I got that right. And what I wanted was, again, that was new champions. With Corbin and Elias, I would have actually predicted a Corbin win. So I got that wrong. And what I wanted was actually a Corbin win, because I actually quite like him as a heel. And then we had Daniel Bryan versus Sammy for the Intercontinental Championship. What I wanted and what I predicted was a Sami Zayn retain. So again, that's one right. So that's two right and one wrong. So moving forward, we had the triple threat. tag team match, tag team ladder match for the SmackDown tag team titles. Now, it was a little bit disappointing. I didn't realise it was going to be a triple threat until quite late on. I'd read it online, but for some reason it hadn't clicked in my head until they actually came out separately. And it was basically a singles match. It was a little bit disappointing just because I was so, so excited for the tag team ladder match. I think it was going to be an absolute classic. I'm not saying this wasn't, but I think it was missing the edge of having it as a tag team match just because they are tag team like members. So with Morrison's high-flying parkour style, I would have preferred Big E because we obviously had Kofi from the New Day. We had Morrison from Miz and Morrison and Jimmy Uso from the Usos. Now, I don't think either Uso would have mattered. They're both very, very similar size, very similar style. Morrison, I would have picked all day long over the Miz, even without like the Miz being ill, especially for this match. But I just think because you've got Morrison and Jimmy Uso that are quite high flyers, then I would have picked Big E because, as we've seen in the past with ladder matches and with table matches and everything like that, Big E can take a bump. And I just think with his strength, it would have added another dimension where having Big E, he could have used his power to maybe catch them off the ladders if they were jumping or falling, or have him pick up ladders with them on it, like we've seen him do in the past. So for me, I would have picked Big E. Now, I don't know why Kofi was there. I don't know what the situation was, but obviously they picked Kofi probably for his high flying ability, and he more than pulled it off. It was very, very good. The beginning of the match was very scrappy, but then when you got to the normal one versus one, one-on-one type part of the triple threat, you know, when one might go outside and he's injured for a bit on the floor and then comes back a little bit later when maybe they've recovered, it felt a lot more strong. It felt a lot more finessed. So can we just say, how slow do they climb the ladder? I mean, if you were in that match, you'd sprint up there. But we all know this happens every time. Like, every single ladder match just gets mentioned. They're very, very quick to save the win. So say Jimmy Uso was up there, Kofi sprints up, Morrison sprints up as fast as he can to block the win. And then as soon as Morrison has a chance to get the win, Jimmy Uso's down and Kofi's down. Suddenly he's, oh, my shoulder. Oh, he's doing one step at a time. He's taking ages. It's a little bit unbelievable, isn't it? Really, if we're going to be honest. But again, that's WWE for you. So some of the big spots were amazing, from Morrison's parkour spin on Jimmy when he was laying on the ladder, Kofi's springboard Hurricane Rana on Morrison from the ladder. I mean, throwing the ladder at Jimmy while he's up on the barricade. And for me, probably the most impressive scene of events was when Morrison did that tightrope walk along the top rope, and then a Spanish fly from the top rope with Kofi Kingston, and then that followed by Jimmy with the Uso splash. It was just a very quick scene of moves, which is spectacular, even without any use of the ladders, which I spoke about in my last Mania prediction episode, meaning that they don't always need the like weapons and stuff. It's just spectacular what them three can perform together, and the three tag teams together. It was just chemistry in motion, poetry in motion, should I say. The finish was with all three members on top of the ladders fighting over the belts at the top, with Morrison falling onto the bridge ladder, which was between the ladder that they were on and the ropes, and then he rolled onto the mat to win. So the belts had fallen down with Morrison during this, so it was his first feat on the mat with the belts to win. I mean, it was a clever finish considering the circumstances, considering the singles match type aspect. I mean, it was a great, great match apart from the start. I love the chemistry the teams have with each other. And obviously with 50% of the chemistry missing, it was a little bit strange to watch at times because, like, for me, when I saw Kofi Kingston, I was you sort of like self-consciously expect Big E to come. And I know you know he's not, and I know you know Jey Uso's not going to come out. But you just sort of expect it in little ways, and you sort of hope, but obviously you realise the situation. But they more than pulled it off. It also needed the crowd in the oh my god type reactions to some of the big spots to get the full effect. But I actually think this was done very, very well by JBL and Carl on commentary. Obviously not as good as a live crowd, especially a WrestleMania crowd of 80,000 plus like fans. But I think the way they commentated the whole match and the way the stars like grew into the match, and the match just got better from start to finish. It just grew, it improved, and it was just a great, great match to watch, and it felt like a WrestleMania match. It was just fantastic. The retain was more because of the singles match aspect, I think. I think in front of a live crowd, in front of a normal WrestleMania situation, that Uso or a New Day win in this type of match would have been a preferred circumstance. But then with no fans and then the singles match, I just think it's probably easier for a retain. But then again, I predicted a retain. What I wanted was an Uso or New Day win. But then again, when I found out it was a singles match, I sort of went away from that. Just because if another tag team won for me, it's a singles match. So when I want when the tag team titles do change hands, I want it to be a tag team win. I want it to be a full tag team win. That's just preference. So that's three right, one wrong. We move on to a bit of a letdown of a match, really. Braun Strowman versus Goldberg. I mean, there was an immense stare down between the two. We never really got an explanation of why Braun Strowman was there, apart from the fact that Roman Reigns was ill. Obviously, he's got his past with the leukemia, so he with the current situation, he's not going to be there. But we didn't actually get a proper explanation of why Strowman was against Goldberg in terms of storyline. Like, we've read all the rumours that Roman Reigns picked him as a replacement, but I'm sure Triple H said something was going to play out to sort of like explain why in a storyline, in kayfabe, like meaning. Well, if that happened, I completely missed it, because I did not see any reason. I had no idea why, apart from Strowman was basically didn't have a WrestleMania match at all, didn't even have a kickoff show or battle royal to be in this year. But anyway, moving on to the match. I mean, it was always going to be a quick match. There was four spears. I mean, two of them were botched and they were very, very close. But anyway, Braun Strowman takes four spears. He then counters a jackhammer, because I was hoping there was never going to be a jackhammer because of that terrible, terrible one he performed on Bray Wyatt. But anyway, he countered the jackhammer to three or four power slams. I don't know, I can't remember how many there was exactly, but anyway, there was a few running power slams. It was a terrible, terrible match, if I'm honest. But to be honest, I'm extremely, extremely pleased Goldberg lost the title. I would love to see The Fiend versus Strowman now, because of the Wyatt family history, because Bray basically made Braun the star he is. So that would be an interesting dynamic, and I think Bray Wyatt would add a hell of a lot of creativity to that match. And as we've seen so far, The Fiend doesn't really need to be great in ring. Obviously, when he has an in-ring match, like a full in-ring match, like he did against Seth Rollins or Goldberg. I know it was probably Goldberg's fault that this match was worse than it was. But Braun isn't fantastic in the ring, so I think the creativity behind the match against The Fiend would more than pull it off. So again, my predictions. I predicted a Strowman win, and if you listened to my episode last week, I wanted more than anything Goldberg to lose the title. So I'm very, very happy with that. So we now move on to part two. So this is a Sunday night. So the first SmackDown match we had was Otis versus Dolph Ziggler. So it was a little bit strange for me, because Otis again, what happened with the old First Tucker, which I touched on in my last SmackDown review, he wasn't built as a powerhouse. He wasn't built as that strong guy. Like, the size of Tucker, the size of Otis in this match, like, against Dolph, because obviously he's not the biggest, like, basically he got beaten up a lot of the time. I wanted Otis to be the aggressor, to be that aggressive. He flipped his switch and he just went nuts, basically. That's what I was hoping for, which is what we saw when he attacked Miz and Morrison, like, a couple of weeks ago. It was a little bit disappointing in the fact that he needed Mandy to get involved with a low blow to Dolph for him to win. Like, I would have preferred, like, obviously some back and forth, like, Dolph, we're not going to expect Otis to absolutely dominate, but I think he needed a dominating part of the match because of his size. I think that's only natural, and especially in a WrestleMania sort of situation, you need that. So Dolph could have got on top for, like, a lot of it, maybe what they were doing, and then suddenly Otis flips, and then he realises maybe Sonya and Dolph have a little conversation, start taking the mic, and he flips. That's what I was sort of like hoping for during the match. I was thinking he's going to flip soon, and it never really came. And then when Mandy got involved, of course she was always going to get involved. She slaps Sonya, distracts the ref, low blows Dolph. That was always going to happen, like, in some sort of way, but I was a little bit disappointed that he really only won because of that low blow, because of Mandy. Like, he's the big enough star physicality, and also he's immensely popular, that you shouldn't book him that you need help, especially at WrestleMania. That was the only little thing for me. And then he obviously performs the Caterpillar. I think he needs a finisher, even if it's just his part of the Compactor, which is the heavy machinery sort of like tag team partnership finisher. Because his part of it is basically just Mark Henry's World's Strongest Slam. And, like, they're similar looks. I don't know whether they're similar sizes in terms of if you stick them together, they probably look very, very different. But you know what I mean, in the stocky, the big, like, you got a belly. They look similar. We haven't had anyone use the World's Strongest Slam for a while, I don't believe. The Caterpillar isn't really a finishing move. Now, I know Scotty Too Hotty had the Worm, and I know The Rock had the People's Elbow. They are funny, they're entertaining, they're just not that realistic, because would you really get pinned from it? I don't think so. Like, The Rock quite often in recent matches, you know, the sort of like WrestleMania comebacks, he normally uses the Rock Bottom after, so that's more of the slam, that's more of the finisher. The People's Elbow is almost like a setup move, a bit like John Cena's Five Knuckle Shuffle. You're never going to get pinned from that. It's more like, it's an entertaining move, not the most painful, but it gets the crowd going and it sets up the finisher. That's what I would prefer, hopefully, going forward. He does get a finishing move if they keep him in a singles match, or they go back to a tag team match. I think moving forward, there's definitely going to be a mixed tag team match coming up on SmackDown. I don't think it will last till the next pay-per-view, but it might do. So it'll be Sonya and Dolph versus Mandy and Otis, which will add a different dynamic. As I said, I was hoping Mandy and Dolph would have some sort of connection, maybe a little time together, because I think Dolph works very, very, very well with a female. And he's got that, it's just not Mandy, so it's Sonya. So they might work very, very well, as he's shown in the past with, like, various females that he's been with. So another prediction right, I wanted Otis to win, as we all did, and he did win. Maybe just not in the fashion that I would have liked, but who cares? That's right, that's five right, one wrong. I'm actually doing very, very well here. Next up, we had the Women's Fatal 5-Way Elimination Match. Now, this was one I was very, very excited for. I was waiting for. I was actually annoyed it wasn't on the first night, just because I was very, very excited to watch it. So we had Sasha Banks versus Bayley versus Tamina versus Lacey Evans versus Naomi. Now, everyone started on Tamina. Everyone attacked the powerhouse, the bigger woman, probably the most, the biggest threat. So they got her dealt with first. She went out the ring. Then we had Bayley on Lacey and Sasha on Naomi. Now, this is the reverse of what it normally is. The feuds that we've seen, the matches that we've seen in recent weeks. It's normally the other way around, but obviously that was going to come later. So that was okay. It was basically 2v2 in some teamwork from both sides, which was nice. Apart from a botched move where Naomi slides in to stop Lacey's landing, because Sasha and Bayley were performing a hip throw, and then Naomi slides in and basically uses her feet as a support to then kick Lacey back over. But she got there too late, so it was basically Bayley and Sasha held Lacey there for a time, for a just short second. Probably was only a second, it felt a little bit longer, but Naomi then slides in, and it just didn't look right. It was a little bit botched, basically. Tamina then came back and attacked everyone, and then leaves Naomi and Sasha and Tamina in the ring. And this is obviously X Team Bad, which was relevant in about 2015. I don't know how long it lasted. I think it lasted a fair while. I wasn't a massive fan of it, but I think it was 2015. They all had a stare down, which led to a little fist bump. Basically, just a little sort of reference to the fact they used to be sort of a team, a little bit of a faction. And then Tamina attacks them both. For me, everyone has their little part to shine, and they all got involved, and this is why it works so well, and it was booked brilliantly by WWE. No one stood out, but no one got left behind, if that makes sense. They all stood out. Everyone was a unit, even though obviously they were attacking each other. Everyone was a unit in this match. It was a solid and strong start to the match, which was very, very pleasing, as sometimes, especially in these packed matches, some stars literally feel like they are making up the numbers. I mean, you just have to look at the Elimination Chamber. You wonder why some people are even in there. But this wasn't the case in this match. Everyone had their part to play and it all seemed relevant. Everyone looked strong. Everyone looked weak at times. It was just good. And not weak as in performance, just vulnerable. So it was perfectly booked. For the first elimination, everyone took turns basically performing moonsaults onto Tamina. And then they all got on top of her because she's powerhouse and 1, 2, 3. So that was her first elimination. We then had the normal feud, which I was talking a little bit about earlier, continue, which was basically Naomi versus Bayley and Sasha versus Lacey. So they had their sort of like one-on-one type things. Sasha and Bayley then yet again teamed up against Naomi, with Naomi getting some momentum and success with a rear view on Sasha, but with the numbers game working against her, she ended up tapping out to a bank statement. So that was the second one. They then continued their teamwork and onslaught onto Lacey. However, with Sasha holding Lacey in the corner, Bayley attempted a running knee, which Lacey moved out of the way and hit Sasha instead. Now, this is the part of the match I was waiting for. We were all waiting for the inevitable clash between the best friends in whatever way it was going to happen, whether it was like a turn, whether it was Sasha attacking Bayley, or either way, whether it was accidental, whether it was deliberate, it was always going to happen. So Lacey tried to get the roll up, which I actually thought would have been the 1, 2, 3, because Bayley was sort of like attending to Sasha in a way, and like was shocked what had happened, because she was obviously like, oh no, I've hit my best friend. But that wasn't the case. She kicked out a few times because Lacey tried a few more times, which is a bit pointless. But anyway, if they kick out the first one, there's no point going straight back for a pin. And then Bayley took her frustration out on Lacey for making her hit her friend. Sasha enters the ring and pulls Bayley up for a confrontation about the knee that she received. Bayley is pleading with Sasha, and Sasha is having a go at Bayley, clearly not accepting it was a mistake. Now, out of nowhere, Lacey lands a big woman's right and eliminates Sasha from the match via pinfall. Bayley goes mad, yeah? So you got to realise that her best friend's just been eliminated. She's gone absolutely like crazy and attacks Lacey using any body part she can, the turnbuckles. Lacey then fights back, and then Sasha re-enters. She performs a backstabber on Lacey, which basically allows Bayley to win. She performs her own move on Lacey after the backstabber, but ultimately she gets the 1-2-3 victory. So Sasha actually helped out Bayley in the end. Sasha picks up the belt and has a brief moment holding and staring at the title before giving it back to Bayley and putting it around her waist. For me, it was just a fantastic match, and it was 100%, 110% WrestleMania worthy. And it was up there with, for me, how good it was. It was up there with the Edge and Orton Last Man Standing match. It was up there with the Boneyard match. It was up there with the Triple Threat Ladder match. It was up there with the Firefly Funhouse match. I mean, the Firefly Funhouse match, as I'll touch on a bit later, that was my favourite by far. But I think for what it was, and I know how creative the Firefly Funhouse and the Boneyard match was, and the Last Man Standing match using the whole arena, the whole performance centre. But if you look at what WrestleMania is, the matches we've had in the past, it was a very, very good match for me. I thought it was excellent. I thought it was excellently booked. And I was just very, very pleased with the way it happened. I think it will be interesting to see what happens on SmackDown, because it's all pointing towards a turn from one of them. Will it be Sasha attacking Bayley, or will Bayley attack Sasha? I mean, that's the way it's all pointing towards. And this move that basically allowed Bayley to win this match and retain her title, I just thought how fitting it seemed, because the move that Sasha performed was the backstabber. So I don't know if that had some sort of meaning or whether it was just a coincidence, but Sasha performed the backstabber to let Bayley win, and then it's all pointing towards some sort of rift between them. Or, of course, does WWE have something else up their sleeve for this going forward? I don't know, but we'll have to see on SmackDown. For my predictions, I wanted a retain, so that was good, because I actually want sort of a screw job angle where one of them screws each other over, which I think is going to come. I think we all are expecting it. My prediction was actually a Sasha win, so that's one wrong. That's two wrong now, and five right. But yeah, I loved that match. So moving on to the final SmackDown match of the night. Well, if you can call it a match, it's John Cena versus The Fiend in a Firefly Funhouse match. Now I'm going to do my best to explain it and then obviously give my thoughts. So John Cena enters the stage and says, "Welcome to WrestleMania," which this is then glitched and it's sort of like hacked. You know, the way Bray Wyatt like sort of like mixes it all up and it sort of like goes down with clips of Vince saying it in the ring absolutely years ago. You know, the classic, like, "Welcome to WrestleMania," that the classic one. You know what I'm talking about. You've probably all seen it anyway. With obviously the Mystic sounds and the usual Fiend-esque vignettes. Bray then very weirdly and intriguingly introduces us all to the Firefly Funhouse, where the match will take place, leading to him leaving through the door at the back of the Firefly Funhouse. So Ramblin' Rabbit then tells Cena where Bray went, because Bray is now in the Firefly Funhouse, and then Cena continues through the door. I must say, the whole setup and the whole vignette is just mysterious. I mean, it's creepy, it's so creative, it's just incredible. Even before any type of match has even happened yet, it's by far the best gimmick I've probably ever seen. Now, this match, the first time I watched it, I was confused up until a point, and then it clicked what was going on. After it, I thought about it, and I've watched it back, and I just thought it was an absolute creative masterclass. So stay with me during this. So firstly, I will recap the match events. Cena left the funhouse and was in a dark room with spooky noises in the background when the devil Vince McMahon puppet appeared and started asking him if he had enough ruthless aggression to like basically win the match. This is just a brilliantly timed, humorous part to start this weird and wonderful match. It was basically taking the mick out of Vince McMahon. It was basically taking the mick out of John Cena because of the ruthless aggression angle. It then appeared as a mix-up of Cena's debut against Kurt Angle, which we all remember, and also Bray Wyatt in the ring copying what Kurt is saying, with the two videos flipping from one another, with Bray and Angle basically finishing each other's words, so it's flipping from one to another. I'm sure you can understand that. The current Cena, in his old debut ring gear, so you know the little pants he wore in his debut, enters a screen in front of the big silver fist, which used to be above the stage on SmackDown back in the day, and then he proceeds to the ring where Wyatt is at. Wyatt is on the mic, and Cena just keeps replying, ruthless aggression, as he did on his debut, and every time he went to slap Wyatt, like he did Kurt in the debut, Wyatt ducks and continues to talk, antagonising him, like winding him up, and each time he just goes, ruthless aggression, like a robot type thing. And then Wyatt goes on to sing Nikki Bella's entrance music, which I just thought was a great touch. It was a personal touch, which it just added. I thought it was actually going to be in a bit of a build up in the war of words type thing, but adding this, it just added that personal touch, which I love. This whole segment then flips to a new clip of Muscle Man Bray introducing his tag team partner, Johnny Large. So John Cena comes out in his old ring gear, which is basically from the indie scene. And he's just pumping loads of weights ridiculously fast. And he's shouting, which is basically a reference to, as I just said, his indie days. So stay with me. It's very confusing. I'm sure if you've seen it, you'll understand what I'm saying. But it's just a lot of individual videos, basically. So then this segment then flipped to a new clip of Thugonomics John Cena in front of the SmackDown Big Fist. And he proceeds to the ring where Firefly Bray is in his sweater. So again, where they were, like talking and basically imitating John Cena's debut. Now Thugonomics, John Cena has come out and basically is meeting Bray Wyatt in the ring. So he now seems to have a little bit more control of what he's doing and what is actually going on. And he performs one of his raps, which he is famous for, which is actually very good. And again, it's personal about Husky Harris's weight, which is Bray's very old character, and also Bray's current character. So Bray responds with a passionate speech about chances, about how John Cena is the golden goose that only wants fame, and basically will step on anyone to get there. Cena then attempts to hit Bray, but he transports across the ring, which was very, very freaky. But Bray now has that chain gang chain that obviously the Doctor of Thugonomics wears around his neck. So he ties it around his fist, like John Cena used to do when he used to have it in the corner or on the turnbuckle, like in his old matches. So he ties it around his fist and then knocks Cena out cold with a punch to the head. So this then flips to a new segment of the old Bray Wyatt in his log cabin, saying that the WWE Universe wanted him and needed him, showing a clip from WrestleMania 30 where all the fans are singing you've got the whole world in his hands, like that song. The whole fans are singing it for Bray. The old Bray then says he's going to rewrite the story, and this is when it flips back to the ring. So where Bray Wyatt, as his old gimmick, he attacks Cena. Cena is now in his normal sort of current gear, or basically WrestleMania 30 gear, but it hasn't changed for a while, so basically his normal gear now. So this shows clippets of the WrestleMania 30 match where John Cena had the chance to take Wyatt out. If you remember, he had a steel chair and Bray Wyatt's on his knees saying, like, finish me, finish it, but he chose not to. So So this is now in the ring currently. Bray Wyatt, using his old gimmick, hands John Cena a chair and says to finish it now. But when John Cena swings for Bray Wyatt, he disappears. So then it flips to a new segment using the WCW entrance theme, with Bray Wyatt in the ring impersonating the old general manager, Eric Bischoff. And he introduces John Cena as if he was part of the NWO, which was a huge, huge faction back in the day for WCW. So John Cena comes out in the NWO merchandise, and doing the air guitar, which was famous from the characters and the members of NWO in Kevin Nash and Hulk Hogan and Scott Hall. So Cena enters the ring where Bray Wyatt is, and he seemingly has more control over himself again. So maybe he's getting used to the Firefly Funhouse, maybe a little bit. But anyway, he attacks Bray Wyatt, and then there's flashes of Cena's memories, Cena's failures. Of like the old WrestleMania days where he's sitting on the ramp because he's just lost to The Rock and stuff like that. And this is clearly fueling his frustration. So he's sitting on top of him and he's just punching Bray Wyatt. When these sort of like flashes are over, he's actually on top of Huskus the Pig and he's punching him. So Cena then gets up. He's looking very, very, very confused, as we all are. And the Fiend is standing there, praying and ready to pounce. He's standing behind him. He turns Cena around. He hits the mandible claw. He then positions Cena ready for his sister Abigail. And then you hear John Cena's own words, which he said on SmackDown a couple of episodes ago in the build-up, about how this current Mania match will finish what happened 6 years ago, and it will end the most overhyped, overvalued and overprivileged WWE star in existence. Now, clearly, the way it was angled, the way it was filmed, the way it was portrayed, Wyatt is now Wyatt's own creativity, referring them words to John Cena. He then hits a sister Abigail. He then hits another mandible claw on the floor to settle the match. He stands tall. The Fiend stands tall. He utters his famous tagline, "Let me in," before the match ends. I mean, this match deserves one word: incredible. The way it linked all the past events, the past characters, the past gimmicks, all together in one story. It mixed it all together in an outstandingly performed and mixed segment. I mean, some people will love it, some people will hate it. I understand it wasn't anywhere near an in-ring match, but the psychological aspect, the sort of like movie aspect, the way it was created, all the thought that had gone into it, from Bray's Firefly Funhouse, it was just amazing to watch. It was a great addition to a stacked 2-day WrestleMania event, and I would go as far to say it was my favourite part of WrestleMania, about how creative and different it was. I think that even if it was a WrestleMania event with fans, I don't know how it would be portrayed in the fact that all the fans in there, so it would be like 80,000 fans maybe, watching it on a screen. I don't know how that would go down. But the fact that we're all at home, there was no fans, so we're all watching it on telly, I think that's why the Boneyard match and specifically this Firefly Funhouse match had so much success, because you're watching it on telly, it went big screen, there was no watching it on the screen from like your seat in the stands or seats when it pans out from the ring and you're watching it on screen. It was just amazing. I thought the creativity of this match was incredible. It was just, I can't overemphasize it enough. The storylines, linking it all in, because some parts you'd forget about John Cena's old bodybuilding character. You'd forgot about some of the other things that had happened, and just the humour behind adding Vince McMahon on commentary, and like the Kurt Angle like debut little thing, and then having Bray Wyatt even address his old gimmick, and everything just all put together into this crazy, crazy match about Firefly Funhouse, about how it was almost like dreamland, and how like it was all psychological in the mind. It was just crazy. My prediction was a Fiend win. I'm sure it was all that. So out of the 6, 7, 8, so there was 9 matches, if I'm correct, from SmackDown. One I'm not going to count because it was Gulak and Cesaro, but well, I suppose, okay, we'll count it as a loss because I didn't predict that one. So I got 6 right and 3 wrong, which is a very, very good effort, I must say, because some of my other predictions in other shows have not pulled off. So I've actually done well in this WrestleMania. I hope everyone enjoyed WrestleMania. I hope everyone enjoyed this podcast. I hope everyone enjoys my episodes. Of course, you can all reach me on Twitter, as always. That's at AidWrestle, AIDWrestle. Very simple. Give me a tweet, give me a follow, give me a DM, whatever you want. I update it regularly with news, some of the speculation, some of the rumours, backstage news, some of the behind the scenes stuff. And of course, you'll find out when my next episodes are published. So thank you guys. Have a good week. And I'll be back next weekend for another SmackDown review. See you later, guys. Stay safe.
You think you know me?